The Spectator magazine is home to wonderful writing, insightful analysis, and unrivalled books and arts reviews. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, along with a free £20 John Lewis or Waitrose voucher. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Welcome to Holy Smoke, the Spectator's religion podcast. I'm Damian Thompson. It took just 17 days between the death of Pope Francis and the election of his successor, Pope Leo XIV. In contrast, it has been many months since Justin Welby was forced out of office as a result of the John Smythe scandal, and it looks as if it's going to be well into the autumn before the Church of England's bureaucratic machinery comes up with the name of a new primate of all England. I'm mystified by the delay. It's many years since I was a religious correspondent of the Telegraph. I used to understand the intricacies of the appointment of bishops and archbishops then, since when the whole process has been changed and reformed. So fortunately, I have here as my guest Andrew Greyston, theologian and author of a book about the John Smythe scandal, and also joined by the Spectator's features editor, William Moore. Andrew, welcome. Could you please give me an idiot's guide? This is me, the idiot, not the listeners, to how the Archbishop of Canterbury is appointed, and then give me some idea of how it's going.
Oh, Damien, it's very, very simple. The King appoints the new Archbishop of Canterbury, the King being the supreme governor of the Church of England. Of course, the King needs someone to tell him who to appoint, and he looks to Sir Keir Starmer, the Prime Minister, to give him a name. And Keir Starmer doesn't know who is an atheist, and Keir Starmer doesn't know who to appoint, so he looks to a body called the Crown Nominations Commission. And let me run through just briefly how that is appointed. There are 20 members of the Crown Nominations Commission. 17 of them get a vote and 3 are there just as observers. And they are chaired by, well, they're going to be chaired in this instance by Lord Evans of Weardale, who is a former director of MI5. And he's been chosen for reasons that we don't know by Sir Keir Starmer. The idea of having a former director of MI5 appointing the Archbishop of Canterbury is entertaining enough in itself.
Delicious, it really is.
Really. I should tell you who the other 16 members of the Nominations Commission are. First amongst them is the Archbishop of York, Stephen Cotterill. He is there by right, and so is the Bishop of Norwich, Graham Usher, who was elected by the other bishops. Now, the interesting thing about them being on the Crown Nominations Commission is that they were the favourite and the second favourite to get the job. And by agreeing to be on the Crown Nominations Commission, they've ruled themselves out of the job. So we're already down to the longer list of candidates.
Can I just ask you, is that because Stephen Cotterill knew he's so useless, which I think he is, that he didn't stand a chance of being appointed, or because he's too old?
There is an issue which I think we'll probably come back to, which is that anybody who is nominated or appointed as Archbishop of Canterbury is going to face intense scrutiny over their safeguarding record.
And he's indeed a very, very delicate area for him.
He's hanging on by his fingertips. He's done well to get through this far still not have to follow his colleague Justin Welby in resigning.
I think that's done very well. I interrupted you. I'm sorry. Carry on with the theoretical side of it.
Right. We are now add to that group 6 what are called central members. And these are all people who've been chosen by an elaborate method by the General Synod of the Church of England. They couldn't just choose 6 people. What they do is they choose 6 pairs of people, and that each of the pair decides that one of them is going to sit on the commission on this occasion. So we know who those 6 are, with one little problem along the way, which is that one of the nominated people from the General Synod was a man called Andrew Corns, and he has had to stand down because of his association with John Smythe. So his place was taken by his pair, who was the Reverend Canon Paul Benfield, and he has had to stand down because, well, we haven't quite been told why, but he was closely associated with a huge safeguarding controversy at Blackburn Cathedral. So he's been replaced by somebody whose name was just picked by one of the General Synod members. So six General Synod members. And then there are five chosen from around the Anglican Communion, from the five different regions of the Anglican Communion. And that's a new, an innovation that was brought in by Justin Welby because of his commitment to the worldwide Anglican Communion. It used to be just one person from the Anglican Communion who was on the Crown Nominations Commission. Now there are five of them, including, for instance, the Archbishop of Jerusalem and the Bishop of Bangor and three others from around the world. And then, if you're still with me, we're almost there. There are three people who are chosen from Canterbury Diocese itself. Used to be more than that, but there are now just three people. And would you believe it, there's been a complete mess over the selection of those three people. Every diocese has to maintain a standing committee called the Vacancy in See Committee, which comes into force when they need a new bishop. Canterbury had a Vacancy in See committee that was elected to serve up to 2024, but nobody thought they were going to be in use because nobody expected Justin Welby to resign until 2026. So the existing Vacancy in See committee in Canterbury, which was supposed to choose its three nominees for the Crown are you still with me? For the Crown Nominations Commission, had fallen into disrepair, so they had to have a fresh election to create a new Vacancy in See committee for Canterbury Diocese. Unfortunately, nobody quite knew the rules. It was so complicated that they end up messing up the election for the Vacancy in See committee. So in May of this year, they decided they had to scrap that, and they are in the presence as we speak of creating a new Vacancy in See committee for Canterbury Diocese that in turn, when it's elected, will have an election to choose three people to sit on the Crown Nominations Commission, and then we'll have them all.
It's amazing, isn't it? I spoke to someone in the Church of England who was despairing and was making the same comparison that Damien made at the beginning. You know, while the Catholics, it took them 17 days in total to get their new pope. At the same time, we at the Church of England, we can't even pick the committee to pick the committee. That's how labyrinthian and complicated the whole process is.
Well, as Andrew put it in an article in Prospect magazine, the process makes a selection of a new pope, as described in the book Conclave and its recent film adaptation, looked like a Mother's Union Tea Party. Although I imagine the internal politics of Mother's Union Tea Parties could be fairly broad.
Well, I think if you were to try to imagine a Robert Harris thriller about the Church of England process, called maybe Synod or something like that, the film adaptation would be 8 hours long. I mean, it would be even a skilled writer such as Robert Harris, who I have great love and admiration for, I think even he would struggle to make it, firstly, understandable, but secondly, very interesting.
Wasn't the Crown Nominations Committee called the Crown Appointments? In my day, it was called the Crown Appointments Commission.
It was, but I think the feeling is that it would be overreaching themselves a bit to appoint someone. They're actually just nominating someone. It used to be that they nominated two people.
That's
and the
right.
Prime Minister picked their favourite. Gordon Brown put an end to that. And now they only nominate one person who goes through, which is a little bit awkward in some circumstances. They've just had an election for a Bishop of Durham, and they only nominated one person, and that person pulled out before they took office. So Durham have had to start the whole process all over again. Now, it is a real possibility that this whole process is going to get stuck along the way for reasons which I could explain, and that we will end up without an Archbishop of Canterbury for a long time, that we might have to rerun the whole thing again.
Well, you've written that the whole appointment of any bishop these days is hugely overshadowed by the LGBT question. So that is the shibboleth, that's the litmus test, as it were, for anybody who wants to become a bishop, and that overshadows the whole process and makes everything very convoluted and miserable.
It does. And there's a couple of things that this appointments process has in common with the Roman Catholic conclave. One is that it's all done in complete secrecy. So although we know who these people are, we're not going to be allowed to know when they meet or what they discuss or whatever. But it, unlike the Roman Catholic conclave, which all meets in this case 32 hours they took to choose a new pope, this lot meet on several different occasions, presumably in some country house hotel somewhere, and we're not allowed to know what's happened. But it takes months and months, so we're not expecting an answer till at least the end of September. That's if it doesn't get stuck. Now, getting stuck is a real possibility, because just like the Roman Catholic conclave, there has to be a two-thirds majority for one particular candidate. And they have to keep talking until they get a two-thirds majority for one candidate. That's all very well when you've got 130 cardinals, but when you've only got 17 in your electoral college, a two-thirds majority is 12. And significantly, that means that just six people could actually block the appointment of any individual. Now, if you can find six people in the Crown Nominations Commission who would, for instance, refuse to appoint a woman bishop, that would stop there being a woman bishop. If you could find six people who will only appoint an LGBT inclusive person, or will refuse to appoint an LGBT inclusive person, then that would kibosh the whole process again. It's not at all unlikely that you could find half a dozen people in that group who would block any particular candidate.
Will, you're a communicant Anglican. What do you make of this?
Well, I agree very much with Andrew about the sort of frustration I sense about how long a lot of this has taken. Although I must say, I mean, one thing I would say, perhaps not exactly in defence of the delay or the lengthy process. However, there perhaps isn't exactly the same degree of urgency as to finding a new pope, only in that, the supreme governor of the Church of England is still there. That's the king. There's also this sort of Protestant element to the whole thing, which means that we Anglicans quite like to ignore whatever it is our archbishops say anyway. So I think there's a lot of the Church of England just sort of carries on as normal. So the kind of urgency to get the new appointment isn't there quite in the same way that it is with Catholics.
And the Church of England is full of people who think they're the Pope anyway.
Well, quite. So where's the urgency? There's only one thing, though, I would say, which I do think... Which is why I would like, obviously, a new archbishop to be chosen and chosen sooner rather than later, because I do think having proper leadership is important. And if you don't have it, then a lot of the more bureaucratic edges of the Church of England, because bureaucracy is going to do what bureaucracy is going to do, they just sort of carry on churning away without anyone stopping them. And I thought of this when Pope Francis died, the Lambeth Palace put out a press release saying, it's a great loss for Catholics that the Pope has died, and we pray for our Roman Catholic brothers and sisters as they mourn his death, and may he rest in peace, rise in glory, and so on. It's a very perfectly good sentiment. But who was sending that release? It's not from anyone. It's just from the palace as a kind of brand, as a blobby brand. It's very odd to me, because the Church of England, I think, shouldn't be like any other institution or like any other type of brand. It is a church, and it should be a person who says such a message. It should be a bishop. And actually, I don't see at all the point of this release from Lambeth Palace, when the Archbishop of York had already done a video message in which he expressed his sentiments. So I don't see why this was needed at all. But it's just an example to me of a kind of out-of-control machine of a bureaucracy.
Exactly. And I wanted to ask you Andrew about that. Do you think this is, in a sense, part of Justin Welby's legacy? I mean, he was appointed to be a sort of managerial whiz kid, instead of which he seems to have been very autocratic, as managerial whiz kids tend to be, but also to have added a few extra layers of bureaucracy, or certainly secrecy, to the Church of England.
It's certainly true in relation to this process that Justin Welby's the changes that Justin Welby made to this process have made it more complicated. He was always very insistent, as others have been before him, that the Archbishop of Canterbury is not the CEO of the Church of England. He's not the Pope of the Church of England. He's just one voice. But the Archbishop of Canterbury is a very loud voice in British society. And there is a real lack of that voice leading and guiding both within the church and potentially giving guidance to the government and to society. That is missing.
In terms of the secrecy of the process, Andrew, I've had people in the church express to me their confusion and in some cases dismay as to the lack of transparency when it comes to how, for example, the five representatives of the Anglican Communion were chosen to be on the CNC. Do we still not know the full extent of the process to how they were picked?
Well, they were chosen. They weren't effectively elected. You couldn't really hold an election across the Anglican Communion. They were effectively chosen by the Anglican Consultative Council, which is a body of bishops and other leaders from across the Anglican Communion. And there were, as there are for Canterbury, there were various stipulations made. They wanted one person from every region of the world. They wanted at least one lay person. They wanted at least two women. So,
and would that include the Episcopal Church of America, or is that now so detached from the Anglican Communion that it doesn't?
It's part of the Anglican Communion, so they will have had a voice in that process. But nobody knows, as William says, that nobody knows quite how those people came to be appointed.
Well, I think it's time to introduce the dreaded journalist cliche, runners and riders. Mm-hmm. Andrew, you've written enough to lead me to suspect that you've got a pretty good idea of who's in the running for this. Could you take us through some of the candidates?
It's a fool's game, really, to predict who's going to get the job. And it's particularly difficult at the moment because one of the issues that the Church of England is facing is that there are no less than 10 dioceses that are, or 11 actually, if you count one that's only just been filled, that are either vacant or just about to be vacant. So that's a quarter of the diocese and therefore a quarter of the bishops ruled off the list already. And then there are some who aren't going to get it because they're too old. Stephen Croft from Oxford, David Walker from Manchester, Stephen Conway from Lincoln. None of those are going to get the gig because they're too old. You have to retire as Archbishop at 70, so there's no point in taking the job when you're 68 or somewhere close to that. So we're going further down the list now. Now, the bookies' favourite, I'm told, is Bishop Gully Francis de Carney, who is the current Bishop of Chelmsford, a very interesting woman, born and brought up in Iran and fled from Iran to the UK and became previously Bishop of Loughborough. And she's highly competent and well thought of, a musician by background, actually. The core question, I suppose, there, before we get too much further into this, is whether it would ever be possible for a woman to be appointed as Archbishop of Canterbury. There's no theoretical reason why that might not be. It's just that almost 75% of the Anglican Communion worldwide, if you count them by membership, don't accept that a woman can be a bishop. So the Crown Nominations Commission is going to know that if they appoint a woman as Archbishop of Canterbury, they will be creating a further crisis in the Anglican Communion. Although, as one General Synod member said to me recently, that hardly matters because the Anglican Communion is falling apart anyway.
Well, that's what I was going to say, Andrew, is that do you think there will be people, maybe even people who will be part of the CNC, who just come to the conclusion that actually it already has broken? I mean, effectively, there are already 12 Anglican archbishops from the the group of the Global South Fellowship of Anglican Churches, which is a conservative Anglican group. And they've issued a statement a couple of years ago now saying that they no longer recognise the Church of England as the mother church of Anglicanism. They don't regard the Archbishop of Canterbury as the first among equals. And so, I mean, do you think there are people who might come to the conclusion it's already shattered, it's already fractured, no point even trying to hold it together?
There are certainly lots of people who think that and feel that way. Justin Welby was very committed to keeping the Anglican communion together. And that's partly why he put five members of the Anglican communion onto the Crown Nominations Commission when previously there was only one representative. But there are plenty of people who think the Anglican communion, the idea of the Anglican communion, is a busted flush and not worth saving.
Well, apart from anything else, the impression I get from the Church of England is that diehard opponents of women's ordination are an increasingly feeble lobby within the Church of England. I mean, even many Anglo-Catholics have secretly or quietly reconciled themselves to women's ordination. And surely I get the impression from talking to Anglican friends of mine that they just take women clergy for granted. So surely that makes the views of the Anglican communion, dominated numerically by Africans and people from other developing countries, really at odds with the Church of England.
Well, that's part of the problem of this appointment, because the one person who's being appointed is going to be not only the Bishop of Canterbury Diocese and the Primate of all England, but also the spiritual leader of the Anglican Communion, as much as the Anglican Communion survives and wants that. So are we actually appointing somebody to be the Bishop of Canterbury and the Primate of all England, or are we appointing someone to be the head of the Anglican Communion worldwide? I mean, theoretically, the Archbishop of Canterbury could come from anywhere around the world. It is slightly hard to imagine appointing an American bishop and then giving them an automatic seat in the House of Lords and the right to crown the next monarch of England. But it's theoretically possible, I suppose. There is this compromise. There is a kind of colonialism built into Anglicanism. The clue is in the name.
Yes. Well, you've mentioned one candidate, both a woman, and somebody with an ethnic heritage outside this country. Even I speak that sort of jargon now. Who are the other front runners?
Martin Snow, who's the Bishop of Leicester. You can tell on the whole who wants to be Archbishop of Canterbury from the people who've tried to say as little as possible in recent months.
I love that point in an article you wrote, because actually the same was true of cardinals in the conclave. Up to a point. Yes. Really hot button issues, they're pretty cautious, the ambitious ones. Yeah.
Now, Martin Snow, I suppose, might be the exception to that, because he has, well, it works both ways. He has been the leader of, from within, the convener, the head from the inside of the Church of England's Living in Love and Faith process, which is the process by which they're trying to come to terms with the Church's understanding of LGBT inclusion. Now, either he gets brownie points for having led that up for the team, or he is ruled out because his inclusive credentials are showing too much. Hard to tell.
Which is interesting, because during Welby's time, the Church of England has drifted pretty relentlessly in a liberal direction, and Welby's own statements on the gay issue would have, you know, enormously surprised somebody who knew him 20 years ago, for example. But for other parts of the Anglican Communion, it's really, and the same was true for many, many cardinals in the conclave, pretty much the only issue that matters.
Mm.
Would you agree?
It is for an awful lot of people. For a number of reasons. One is that the conservative end of the Church of England is where the money is. And that does matter quite a lot if you're trying to sustain a a fragmented church. So the Church of England's Evangelical Council, which is the conservative club, the conservative tribe within the Church of England, has nominated a group of seven candidates who they would accept as Archbishop of Canterbury. Six of those are out and out evangelicals, and one is an Anglo-Catholic who, but the one thing they all have in common is that the exclusion of LGBT people. So that the Church of England Evangelical Council has its own nominated candidates. They would prefer Paul Williams, the Bishop of Nottingham, or Jonathan Gibbs, the Bishop of Rochester, or Andrew Watson, the Bishop of Guildford, or their great favourite would actually be Archbishop Kanishka Raphael, who is the Archbishop of Sydney. Now, that feels pretty impossible, to be honest. That, I mean, Sydney is the most conservative Anglican diocese in...
It was almost like sort of 17th century Calvinists, certainly until recently.
Yeah, so the idea that they're going to drag somebody across the world from Sydney to be the Archbishop of Canterbury is pretty far-fetched. Likewise, the idea that they're going to choose Philip North, the Bishop of Blackburn, who has...
He's a real Anglo-Catholic, isn't he? Or what passes for Anglo-Catholic these days.
A high Anglo-Catholic. He works alongside women, but doesn't believe that women should be ordained in the Church of England, so he won't go there. An outside candidate might be Bishop Pete Wilcox, Bishop of Sheffield, who has kept very quiet on a lot of issues. He's conservative as far as LGBT issues go, but he's a scholar. He's an outside candidate. Mark Tanner would be in that category as well, the Bishop of Chester. Likewise, a conservative, quiet, almost to the point of making no noise at all within the Church of England, but because of that, has fewer enemies than most.
In terms of what Damien just called the kind of liberal drift, you might call it, of Welby, I would love your opinion on this, Andrew, but in my mind, it seems to me that when it comes to gay weddings and gay blessings and the entire LGBTQ issue, Welby has kind of pushed it as far up to the line as it's pretty much possible to go without changing church teaching. And I don't know if you agree with that analysis, but it seems to me that now the church is in a position which has pleased pretty much nobody. Yes. And I'm not sure how long that can actually hold for, one way or the other.
Yeah, they've been in this process called living in love and faith for, well, the whole of Welby's tenure, really. And his aim seems to have been to make sure that the thing didn't fall apart at whatever cost, whatever damage to people on whatever side of the argument, and irrespective of what he or anybody else thought that the gospel might be saying, they wanted the church to stay together. So whoever gets this gig will find themselves from the beginning walking a tightrope, not wanting to lean a fraction to one side or to the other, because they know that if they do that, the church will split. There's a large chunk of the church that is just waiting to leave on the in a huff on the strength of the LGBT inclusion issue. The thing that's keeping them, that large chunk of the church, in is that they would rather be thrown out than walk out. Because if they're thrown out, they get to keep the pensions and the vicarages and whatever else. If they walk out, then they go with nothing. So that is a...
This is fascinating. What would be the status of conservative Anglicans who had been thrown out?
Well, if you're thrown out, what that effectively means is that you no longer come under the authority of a bishop, so you can no longer call yourself a member of the Church of England, but you're still a bishop or a priest. That doesn't you're almost nothing. In fact, there is nothing, I think, at the moment that can take that away from you.
So they might be a bit like the Lefebvreists in the Catholic Church, for example. Yeah,
something like that. Yeah. So whoever gets this gig is balancing all those things. One of the leading candidates said to me a while back, you mustn't think that there's a load of bishops around jockeying for position for this. What's actually happening is a lot of bishops sitting around a table passing a revolver from one to the other, knowing that one of them is going to get the bullet.
Maybe the cleverest thing Graham Asher did was to accept his position on the CNC then. He's ruled himself out.
I think that was probably quite a smart move, and I'm not party to what goes on in his soul, but I would have thought that that is the way that it's going to go. That's motivating a lot of people. The scrutiny you're going to get as soon as your name is announced is going to be overwhelming. I mean, one of the names that some of the more moderate people have suggested that they should make a kind of interim appointment, an appointment for just 3 or 4 years. And the name that comes up there is Sarah Mullally, the Bishop of London, who actually doesn't want the job and has said so. But although having said that, saying that you don't want the job is the first qualification for getting the appointment. But I suspect Sarah Mullally genuinely doesn't want the gig. And one of the reasons is that she is sitting on a safeguarding powder keg in her diocese. And if she did get the job, then a great many stories are going to come out about things that the Diocese of London has done or hasn't done in relation to safeguarding. So
really,
she would have a very hard time.
Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Without wanting at this stage to go into huge amounts of detail, one of the most obvious cases is that the previous director of operations for the diocese, a man called Martin Sargent, is currently residing not in the diocesan office, but at Her Majesty's pleasure, having defrauded the diocese of in excess of £5 million. That's the tip of an iceberg in the Diocese of London. There are a number of other uncomfortable stories that the bishop would know about, but are waiting to emerge.
Can I ask both of you, do you think the time has come to separate the Church of England from the Anglican Communion, which, I mean, it barely exists as a communion? They're not really in communion with each other. And it's a fairly recent concept, the Anglican Communion.
It would make me very, very sad in that this is where you're going to accuse me, I think, perhaps, or maybe you won't, but you might think of me as being very sort of wishy-washy and maybe hippy-dippy, but I'm quite an ecumenical person, I think, and I like the idea of as much of a united church as possible. So instinctively, I like the idea of Anglican Communion. I like the idea of the kind of unity of it. But you are kind of right, I think, Damien, that actually in practice, as I said earlier, it basically has already broken. I think that people may not want to recognise that, but I think that is actually a bit of an unavoidable reality.
And Andrew, if the Anglican Communion were ditched as a concept, and I'm not saying that's immediately on the cards, but I saw the way that not just Justin Welby, but Rowan Williams found it almost impossible to deal with their dual role. But if the concept of the Anglican Communion were ditched and it was just the Church of England, wouldn't the whole process be more manageable? Wouldn't it be easier to come up with someone who reflects the wishes and the thinking of ordinary Anglican worshippers?
It would make life a bit easier. I mean, the Anglican Communion is in effect parallel with the Commonwealth, a great idea, but something that depended on a relationship between countries that existed previously and no longer does exist. We know that the job of Archbishop of Canterbury is ridiculous. We know that it's impossible. As long as 20 years ago, there was a report into this.
Douglas Hurd.
Yeah. And he said, there are at least 3 different jobs going on here, and you need 3 different people to do them. You need somebody to have oversight of Anglicans worldwide, and you need somebody to have oversight of the Diocese of Canterbury, and you need somebody else to have oversight of Britain. His suggestion was that the Archbishop of Canterbury should look after the Anglican Communion, the Archbishop of York should look after all of England. But of course, none of that has happened. And I mean, it was only 20 years ago. It'll be another century before the Church of England manages to make any progress on that sort of thing.
Final question. The appointment is nominally made by His Majesty. The King has strong views on the Church of England, though we're not entirely sure what they are, but he's a man whose spirituality has grown and developed over the years. I'm not sure exactly where he stands on various topics, which is perhaps as it should be, but do you think the king will try and influence the process, or do you think that the committee might try and anticipate his wishes in some way? Could I ask both of you that?
It wouldn't be the Church of England if there weren't quiet conversations being had over port and cigars at various points. And that, of course, is the way these things get done, not through the palace leaning on anybody in any direct way, but through quietly making known what the king's views might be.
And the king, unlike, is perhaps more of a leaner than his mother was, isn't he, naturally?
Yes, I think he probably is. And of course, one of the interesting factors is that we know a little bit more about what the Prince of Wales feeling about these things is. And he is, by his own accounts, much less interested in being governor of the Church of England than the king is.
Apparently he didn't even go to church at Easter.
Yeah, so those who are committed to the establishment of the Church of England are going to have a more challenging time in the days ahead, perhaps.
Yes. Well, what do you think?
Well, I think Andrew's pretty much bang on, actually. I think, as you actually said, Damien, we often don't know quite what the king's actual views are on things. We know he's a bit almost Eastern in kind of mysticism, kind of Anglican mystic in some ways. He likes a lot of that. We had that, I thought, beautiful and superb Greek Orthodox chant of Psalm 71 at his coronation. It was very, very moving. So we know he has at least that sort of a vibe to his faith, you might say. In terms of those issues that Andrew has spoken about so eloquently on this podcast, you know, the issues of, let's say, safeguarding or LGBT inclusion or any of these other things, we don't know what the king thinks about that. But also, as Andrew says, I'm sure that behind closed doors, some of these conversations are being had. I certainly don't want to overstate the influence here because none of us know. But it is interesting because we do have a king who is more open about his faith, a bit more vocal about his faith than his mother was. I mean, as devout a Christian as the late queen was, and none of us would doubt it, she was very quiet about such things. And the king is a little bit more outspoken about his personal belief. So I think that whatever those conversations being had, I'm sure they are very interesting.
I think the whole thing is going to be very interesting. Well, if you're interested in that sort of thing, let's say, it's certainly going to be very complicated.
If I wanted to put an outside bet on for a long shot for the Archbishop of Canterbury, I would go for Bishop Martin Gordon, who is currently the Bishop of Goma in Congo. And he's a Brit, but he's been living and working in Africa. The fact that he's been out of town means that he's got clean hands. But the fact that he's been working in Africa means that he has some appeal to the rest of the Anglican communion. So my outside bet is on Martin Gordon, the Bishop of Goma.
Can we look at Patrick? What's the bet fare?
I was just thinking we're going to have to end the podcast now while I make a quick phone call. Andrew Grayson and William Moore, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you so much, David.
Thank you.